The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Control, this is Bravo 229er. We're under the skin. Everything looks fine.
Soarin' to tower. We are ready for takeoff.
Mama, don't whoop little Buford. I think you should shoot him instead.
Gentlemen, direct from a record-breaking 2 million years at the bottom of the evolutionary ladder, let's hear it for...
WDW Radio,
your information station.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the WDW Radio Show, your Walt Disney World information station. I am your host, Lou Mangiello, and this is show number 343 for the week of November 24th, 2013. I'm here to help you have the best possible Disney vacation experience and bring you a little bit of Disney magic wherever you are with this podcast, my new Disney in a Minute videos, blog, live broadcasts, special events, my Walt Disney World trivia books, audio tours, and more. You can find it all over at wdwradio.com. This week's show is brought to you by audible.com, where you can get a free audiobook download by visiting audibletrial.com. If you don't have time to read a book, one of the best ways to enjoy it is on your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or any MP3 player device. There's lots of Disney titles to choose from. Again, you can visit audibletrial.com/WDW Radio. You can sign up, get your free audiobook, and download anytime. Again, audibletrial.com/WDW Radio. So this week, we will remember and celebrate the life of Walt Disney's daughter, Diane Disney Miller, who passed on November 19th, 2013. We're going to look back at her life, growing up with Walt Disney as her dad, her influences on him, her marriage to Ron Miller, her work at preserving her father's legacy, the Walt Disney Family Museum, and many personal, firsthand stories about Diane, the true keeper of her father's flame. I'll then have the answer to our last Walt Disney World trivia question of the week and pose a new challenge for your chance to win a Disney prize package. Then stay tuned as I'll have some announcements and updates, including information about our next WDW Radio Meet of the Month in Walt Disney World Holiday Edition and special movie screening. Then I'll have more of your voicemails at the end of the show. So sit back, relax, and enjoy this week's episode of the WDW Radio Show. On November 19th, 2013, just a day after the Disney community celebrated the birthday of Walt's most famous son, Mickey Mouse, they also, unfortunately, had to mourn the loss of Walt's first daughter with the passing of Diane Disney Miller. And today on the show, I'm joined by Jim Korkus as we remember Diane and maybe share some stories about her personal life growing up as the daughter of Walt Disney, as well as what she did later on in life, really preserving feverishly the legacy of her father, the man, not her father, the corporate symbol. So I want to welcome back Jim Korkus. He is the author of The Vault of Walt, Volume 1 and Volume 2, and a brand new book, which we'll talk about at a later time, called The Book of Mouse, a celebration of, appropriately enough, after his birthday, Walt Disney's Mickey Mouse. Jim, welcome back.
Lou, always a pleasure. We're over here at the Polynesian, where Lou just treated me to breakfast at the Kona Cafe. However, the real treat was as we were eating, half dozen people came over and recognized Lou's voice and came up and congratulated him. I don't know how Lou ever gets a chance to eat anything at all for that.
Well, how about the people that come up to you and said, Jim, I hear your voice all the time, but I never realized how devastatingly handsome you are.
Which, of course, never happens at all. And if we're going to be totally honest, at breakfast this morning, I'm sort of an afterthought. They can't take their eyes off of Lou. And Lou is very gracious and go, oh, and by the way, there's Jim Corkins. And they look over and they go, oh, hi, Jim. Yes, it's great to meet you. And then they're back to Lou and talking about how great it was he was in Spider-Man 500. So that's a real treat. And it's a wonderful day out here today. We're outside of the Poly now, and all of the Disney resorts are just beautiful, but this is a special treat, and it's also a special treat to talk about Diane Disney Miller, who I knew and who was very supportive of my writing and my work. And I will tell you that when I first heard the news, it was very similar to what several animators told me when they heard the news about Walt Disney. It was like somebody hit you in the chest and all the air left out of your body, because it just seemed unbelievable. It really did seem like Diane was going to live forever. She was physically fit. When I was speaking over at the Disney Family Museum, I was just astounded. I saw her bound up two steps at a time up the stairway, you know, with no effort whatsoever. And her mind was razor sharp, and she was so excited about so many projects that she was working on and planning. And I think the true loss of Diane really won't come to light for several months now, maybe a year, when we start to see things happening or not happening at the Disney Family Museum and Disney research and all of that. But
I think the thing is, you know, when we all sort of heard of her passing, it was a shock to everyone because she wasn't sick. She wasn't sick. This is not something, like you said, sort of analogous mm-hmm. to Walt. This sort of came out of left field. We come to find later on that she did suffer a fall in September, and this was as a result of complications to that. So it very much was a surprise to people. But I will tell you, from the, you know, from a Disney community perspective, it was amazing to see the instant response from people on the social networks and Twitter and Facebook, this outpouring of concern and love and support for someone who a lot of people really never got to meet personally, but they understood very quickly her importance to not just the company and the brand, but really the family.
And I will tell you personally, and the people who are listening as well too, that Diane absolutely, sincerely loved it when people came up and told her thank you or how much her father had meant to them and all of that. And she was always gracious. She was always focused directly on the person when a person would say that, and she was just a very classy lady. And so what we're going to try and do on this podcast is not mourn her passing, which again was this surprise from a stupid accident. People didn't even realize she was in the hospital, and the complications were quite severe. But those of us who knew always hoped that, you know, she was going to pull out of this. But we need to celebrate who she was and how much she has contributed. But yes,
and I think think a lot of people, and I think this is important too, because I think a lot of people know the name, but they don't really know who she was. They know that she was one of Walt's two daughters. They may not know she was the only biological daughter. Her younger sister Sharon was adopted, and so I think you're right. I think it's important that we, you know, talk about her not just as Walt's daughter, but who she because of what she did later on in life too.
Well, and you know, it's interesting you bring that up, because she really was a miracle baby. Walt had wanted, like, and he told people this, he wanted like 10 kids. He wanted a huge family. Now, Lillian, his wife, had come from a huge family, so she wasn't as excited about having another huge family. But anyway, what happened is they had tried for many years to have a child. And Lillian had had two miscarriages, which of course had devastated both Lillian and Walt. And so on this pregnancy, it was a healthy pregnancy, although they did things like, you know, make sure Lillian doesn't leave the house and that type of thing. And on December 18th, 1933, Walt was at the Disney studio for a luncheon where Parents Magazine was giving him an award for distinguished service to children. And he was constantly getting these. He got an award from 17 magazine at one point. So anyway, the woman from the magazine had made this elaborate presentation and Walt Disney's many accomplishments and had given him the award. And just as she was giving him the award, a note had been brought in, and somebody rushed up to Walt and whispered in his ear. And he grabbed his hat and just mumbled, thank you, and then ran out. And it was up to the speaker to inform the rest of the audience that Walt had just been informed that his wife had gone into labor at Good Samaritan Hospital. And they should all, you know, raise their glasses in honor of his new baby that was coming, Diane Marie Disney. And so everybody, you know, eagerly did that. Interestingly enough, the next day in the Los Angeles Times, they had the headline, Mickey Mouse Has a Daughter. So Walt rushed to the hospital. Lillian said that as she was being put under anesthesia there, the last thing she heard was Walt's cough. And so Diane Marie Disney, bouncing baby girl, Walt was just ecstatic. Of course, he wanted a boy, but he figured, you know, boys would be coming too. He was happy with Diane. And here is a private story that Diane Disney Miller told me. You won't find this in any books. You'll only you only would have heard it from Diane, or you would hear it on this WDW podcast. And Diane, of course, was very private about sharing certain stories because she felt these were the stories of her and her dad. And once you get that out there, then it belongs to all these other people. You know, she wanted some memories that were just hers. And so a week later, a week from December 18th, that's December 25th, that's Christmas. And in 1933, what had happened is the very popular cartoon Three Little Pigs had been released. And of course, Lillian hadn't seen it. So in the nursery, Lillian is there with Diane. Diane, 1 week old, and Walt comes in and sets up a screen. I think some of you may be old enough to know what that was like, coming in and pulling out that screen, and you turn it this way and you pull that way and all of that. And Walt ran for them, the three little pigs. And Lillian looked over to Walt, and she had laughed through the cartoon, and she said, well, seeing this cartoon, it makes me wish that I had given you, and Walt thought that she was going to say, oh, a son, and she said, triplets. and they both laughed. Now, Diane really was a miracle baby, because apparently there were some physical problems there, because a year or two later, Lillian tried to have another child and suffered another miscarriage, and her doctor just sat her down and Walt and said, you know, it would just really be unwise to try that again. So in 1937, they adopted a two-week-year-old, another daughter, Sharon May. And Diane and Sharon were to be, you know, the best playmates. But Diane said, I thought she was just absolutely useless. They made this big deal about bringing home a playmate for me from the hospital, and the bassinet was so high, I couldn't look. You know, I was about 3 years old. I couldn't look over. I saw these frills. It didn't move. It didn't talk to me. She said, I thought it was just absolutely worthless. And she said, those first few years, because there was that gap, she couldn't do anything that I wanted to do. And so I put a sign on my bedroom that said, everybody can come in except Sharon Disney. And she said she'd just sit in the doorway and look at me, and I'd say, go away, I hate you. And she said, and all of my friends at school hated their sisters too, so this seemed fine. And Diane said, isn't it just amazing that any of us grow up at all after all the terrible things that happen to us and the terrible things we do when we're kids?
And how brothers and sisters actually get along with each other after all the torture that we put each other through. So, and obviously, as they grow up, this is when we start to hear about Diane and Sharon's influence in a lot of what we look, you know, because of where we are today, we can think about, you know, we know the stories about Walt on Daddy's Day and how important his kids were to him, as busy as he was running this company and trying to do what was, you know, Saturday was Daddy's Day. That was the day he took his daughters out, and we've heard the legendary stories of taking them to Griffith Park and sitting on the bench and watching them on the carousel. But it's important to sort of recognize that what we enjoy today is because of that. And, you know, we talk all the time about lessons that we learn from Walt Disney and things that he taught us about, you know, business and entrepreneurship and this sort of never die spirit. But I think one of Walt's most important quotes is, you know, a man should never put anything ahead of his family. And he really was a family man first and foremost. I think people kind of forget that and what an influence his kids had on his life and his business, too.
Absolutely true. And in fact, he tried to keep his family life separate from the studio life. Now, some of that was the result that around this same time was the Lindbergh baby kidnapping. And so a lot of celebrities were very concerned about that and added bars to the windows of their house and all of that. But Walt kept his daughters out of the spotlight because he wanted them to have, you know, as normal a life as they could possibly have.
So is it true that he drove his girls to school?
He drove his daughters to school every day. And in fact, Diane shared a very funny story with me when she was in elementary school. This little girl, one of her classmates, came up and said, if I give you a nickel, can I look at your dad when he drops you off tomorrow? And Diane said she was just infuriated at it. It was her dad. Why would anybody want to look at her dad and all that? So the next day she purposely made Walt park a block away from school just so this little girl wouldn't peek out from a tree looking at Walt.
And you wonder when that started to happen, at what age she starts to recognize sort of who her father really is.
Well, in elementary school, of course, there's that very famous story, and Walt loved telling it too, is that at night he'd be sitting in this big chair with his brown battered briefcase next to him, and he'd have scripts in his lap, and he'd be going over that. And he said, Diane came in and gave me that dirty Disney look, and which Walt gave to employees, and he wasn't used to having it given to him. And she says, give me your autograph. And he says, well, why do you want my autograph? And she says, well, this girl at school asked if you were Walt Disney, and she wanted your autograph. And are you Walt Disney? And, Walt laughed and said she didn't even know what an autograph was. Diane told me she was really infuriated. She had as much a temper as her dad did. It would explode like a volcano, and then it would dissipate. And she said, I just yelled at him, you never told me you were Walt Disney. You know? And that was it. So in elementary school, they got a little brief taste. But, you know, Walt could have really have leveraged them. Imagine having pictures of your daughters hugging, a Mickey Mouse doll or dressed up as a Disney cartoon character for Halloween or whatever. You get no pictures of Diane and Sharon until, you know, much, much later, other than just, you know, home movies and the home pictures that were taken. And Walt was a devoted father. Not only did he drive them to school every day, he'd drive them to Sunday school and then pick them up after Sunday school. And Diane said Sunday was the best day because Daddy was home all day. and he taught them how to swim. Walt didn't know how to swim, but he taught them how to dog paddle. He'd be in the pool, and they'd jump into his arms, and he'd teach them how to. He taught them how to ride horses and things like this. And
he'd teach them how to drive, like when they were like 12. Right?
Yeah, 12 years old. Taught them how to drive a car. He had taught them how to ride bicycles in the studio parking lot. And taught them how to drive cars when they were 12 years old in the studio, and they hit things and all that. And Diane said, oh, yeah, it was great. We'd follow him around, and we'd get ice cream out of the ice cream machine. And then she and Sharon would run into one of the empty sound stages and do a shouting contest because there was an echo and all of this going on. And so Walt never talked to them about, you know, the studio or the cartoons or... Gee, I'm strapped for cash and all of that. She told me Walt, of course, had told a story when Snow White came out, where people were criticizing that the old witch, the old hag, was just too scary for kids. And he says, "Oh no, my kids, you know, just love the witch." And I asked Diane about that, and she said, "Well, yes and no." She said the first time I saw Snow White, it was at the studio, and she said as soon as the old witch came on, I started screaming and crying, and before I knew it, I was outside standing. And Daddy was there saying it was all right. And she said, but one of the games that Walt would play with her and Sharon was the old witch. And he'd go, "The old witch is coming." And they'd yell and scream and run around the house and try to hide in corners. "Here comes the old witch." And she said, oh, we just love that game. We just love that game. We just laugh so much. And so she also said, you know, we were treated like normal kids. You know, obviously Dad had the money to get us anything we wanted, pretty much. You know, one time I wanted a piano, and we didn't get it because he felt that we shouldn't get everything that we asked for, and that some of the things that we did want, we needed to wait for to see if that was really something we needed to have. So Walt, just a magnificent... a father, and hearing Diane, and what a shame that people now won't be able to hear this from Diane herself. Hearing Diane tell these stories, you just see her become a child again, and just lighting up. That it was just she told me Sharon and I decided that when we grew up we were going to marry Daddy. And then we discovered horses and decided we were going to marry a horse. And then we discovered boys. And she says, I think Daddy was very upset about that by then. So, wonderful, wonderful stories. Now, Lou, you met Diane briefly, didn't you?
I did. I had I was fortunate enough to meet her on two occasions. Again, very briefly, normally sort of in crowded environments. And the last time I met her was when we did our group trip out to the Family Museum just this past April. We happened to be there while something else was going on. And I saw Diane and Ron, a number of the other family members and children there. And it was one of those things that... you know, it's one of those opportunities that you sort of feel that you need to go over and say hello or introduce yourself or say thank you, whatever it was. And I was really surprised, Jim, again, the second time, how accessible, how welcoming, how friendly she was. She didn't feel as though you were making you feel like you were bothering her at all, despite everything else that was going on around you. She was laser focused on you as if you were the only person in the room. She was very friendly. She greeted you with a smile, sort of a very warm handshake. And, you know, you said before, there was a certain class, a certain elegance and refinement to her, sort of that very old-school style that you were seeing. It really impressed me, and it really sort of it struck me at there was no celebrity to her at all. It wasn't, hey, I'm Walt Disney's child. But it was nice to be able to go and say, you know, thank you for what you did with this museum. I mean, you know, we talked about sort of, my gratitude for her preserving her father, the man, her dad's legacy like that. And I was very, very, very impressed just by her personally.
And again, yeah, almost regal, like royalty. And yet, yes, as you said, you know, very friendly and very interested in you as a person. You know, not that, well, I'm, you know, Diane Disney Miller and all of this. And, you know, she was just like her dad. She was as simple and as complicated as you might expect. You know, at one moment you might run into that keen, no-nonsense business woman. You know, she once described herself as, you know, well, I'm just a housewife, and her husband Ron joked, "Yeah, if you like your housewives tougher than steel, yes, she is." You know, and then the next moment, you would find this very shy, self-effacing, almost like a Midwest grandmother who could sometimes be, you know, just a little ditzy and distracted, and it would flip-flop. You know, you wouldn't know which one, but. What a magnificent woman. And, of course, when she moved up to the San Francisco area, she was involved in the Bay Area Art Council up there in the Symphony Orchestra, was on the board for that and all of that, had a real appreciation for the arts. But we're sort of skipping ahead on the story. She went to Immaculate Heart, which was a girls' school on Las Feliz, and she actually considered becoming a nun. You know, at one point. And then she moved to USC. And her major was English because she wanted to be a foreign correspondent. And in fact, she loved writing. And even as a kid, her dad would take her writing to the studio so that Storymen and all could go over it and see if it was any good, if there was any potential, whatever. You know, he wanted her to write the screenplay for Lieutenant Robin Crusoe, USN. And when Diane turned that down, that's when Walt, you know, roughed out the story himself after he came up with the story idea. And and Diane always said, yeah, he always thought I was the intellectual, I was the smart one, and Sharon was the pretty one, because Diane was a little bit of a tomboy. Well, at USC... Diane told me that, you know, she had sort of adjusted to the fact that people would look at her dad as a curiosity, but she said in college, that's when she got the first experience of her being looked at as a curiosity. In fact, her first day there in the freshman dorm, a girl came running up to her and said, "Did you hear the news? Walt Disney's daughter is going to be attending here." And Diane said, "I just kept my mouth shut because all I could think of is that poor girl. What's going to happen when she realizes she's talking to me, you know, and telling me this?" And on a blind date, she met this tall and attractive young guy. She's 19. Met this tall and attractive football player, Ron Miller. Now, in the past, the Disney family had not always approved of people Diane had gone out with. You know, it was like nobody was good enough for our little princess type thing. But they did take a liking to Ron, although Diane said Ron didn't like staying around the house too much, whether he was afraid or intimidated or whatever. And she said, "One day I was there waiting for Ron to come pick me up, and Mom and Dad came in and said, 'You know, we really like Ron, you know, and we think you're old enough so that if you ever decide you want to get married, we think you could, and we think Ron is a good catch.'" And she said, "I almost dropped over dead. My dad had given me lectures that he didn't want us to be married until we were at least 30, because you don't understand anything until you... And here I am, 19 years old, and they're saying, 'Well, you know, Ron might be...'" And so I told Ron, and Ron flipped as well. And there was this look on his face like he was trapped and didn't know what to do. We had talked about marriage because, you know, we'd been going out and we couldn't see ourselves seeing anybody else. And she said a couple of days later, Ron came over for dinner, and my dad and my mom came in and said, "Well, we understand you're thinking about getting married." And so Walt wanted to throw this huge wedding and all that. But Diane had been raised that, you know, it's your private life. It's nobody else's business. And so she wanted a small wedding up in Santa Barbara with just a few close friends and family. Sharon was her maid of honor and the only attendant she had. And Ron's brother was his best man. And she also got a taste of it because in L.A. she went and they went to get the marriage license, and suddenly there were four or five photographers who would just, I guess, hang out in the courthouse to see if any famous name comes out. So they got married in a small ceremony up in Santa Barbara, and Episcopalian church up there. And as part of that ceremony, the minister says, "Who gives away, you know, this woman?" And the father says, "Her mother and I, you know, do." And she says, before it got to that point, she was hearing this sobbing, and she turns, and there's tears running down Walt's face, and he can barely say these words. And she says, "I reached out and I grabbed his hand and gave it a little squeeze, and we just looked at each other, and we went on with the ceremony." And she said, by the time of the reception, he was his old gay, funny self. He was, you know, laughing and the life of the party and all of that. And she says, you know, this was 1953 they got married. And Ron was on the verge of being drafted. In fact, 5 months later went into the military. And so Walt did everything he could to help the newlyweds. Illegally, he loaned them the studio car because they couldn't afford a car. So the car they drove around to pick up groceries was the studio car. She says, "I don't know whether we should be telling people that. That's illegal now." And he designed their first house, and then used the architects at the Disney studio to help, you know, refine some of those things. But he's the one. And she says he knew everything about space. And she said, you know, I'd come over and he'd pull out his wallet and pull out $10, and he says, "You probably need this." And I said, "No, Dad, no, no, no." And he says, look, this is the only way I can give you something without the government taking part of it, you know. Do this. And when Ron came back from the they had their first child, Christopher, and Walt was sort of disappointed it wasn't called Walter. And then Diane had a couple of girls after that, but eventually there was a Walter Elias Disney Miller. And so Walt finally got, and he says, "And you put the Elias in there too." He finally got that, but he loved his grandchildren. And Diane said, "I knew he always wanted a big family, and so this was one of the ways I could pay him back, was by giving him all these grandchildren for him to enjoy." And then when Ron came back from the military, he was continued to play at USC because she was 19. Ron was just barely 20 when they got married. You know, he was going to be a professional football player. And Walt saw one of those games where Ron got sacked. And he says, "No, he's working at the studio. I'm not having my son-in-law out there getting hit by all of this stuff." And so, you know, Diane led, you know, a nice, quiet life. With the passing of her dad in 66, she actually took his place on the board of directors of the Disney studio. A lot of people don't realize that. And, of course, Ron was promoted to president. And then in 78, I believe, he became CEO of the Disney company as well, to keep that Disney legacy alive. And we can do a whole another podcast on Ron, because he made so many contributions to the Disney company. It's because of him there was the Disney Channel, there was the Touchstone brand and Splash as a movie.
Condor Man.
Condor Man, yes.
The Black Hole.
Right. You know, but he did make some significant. In fact, Disney's first foray into Broadway was under Ron, and Ron brought in Tim Burton. Well, we'll go on with that, but he got shoved out in 84. You know, you know, Diane was quite content to live this, you know, quiet life and of philanthropy. Mm-hmm. You know. Contributing and supporting so many organizations, but again, doing it quietly. And so you don't have any quotes from Diane about, you know, new right. Disney films coming out or Mickey.
Right. She was not really involved with the company at all. She was doing her own thing.
Absolutely. In fact, when I first met her and started to talk to her, she said, "Well, I love the stories that you write because I only knew Dad at home. I didn't know Dad at work. So when you're sharing some of these stories, You know, it's giving me, you know, it fills in some of the jigsaw puzzle pieces, some of the things that are missing. And so in 76, along with Lillian, Diane and Ron bought some land up in Napa Valley in San Francisco. And then by 1980, they opened this Silverado Winery because they found that, you know, the fruit they were producing and all this were producing some pretty nice wines for other people. They might as well just do this themselves. And so more or less moved up to San Francisco because Diane was fed up with the Disney studio and how it was being run and all of that, and that her husband had been pushed out, you know, unceremoniously and then blamed for everything that was wrong and not given credit for anything that was right, and was going to spend the time up there. And again, she got involved with organizations up there in the Bay Area and all of that. It wasn't until 1997, and that's when Lillian passed away. Lillian had donated $50 million to the building of the Walt Disney Concert Hall in Los Angeles because the family wanted Walt's wealth to be used for something that would you know, benefit the community, benefit the arts, all of that. But when Lillian passed away, the committee decided that, no, they weren't going to go with Frank Gehry, that he his company was inexperienced and all of that. At that particular point, Diane stepped in and withheld the rest of the money and said, this is what we agreed on, is he is going to do this, and I support his design and the whole bit, and that's all there is to it. And so Gehry was brought back, and actually the board was very gracious. Once the hall opened in 2004, they said, no, Diane was absolutely right. Whatever misgivings we had were completely wrong. This was it. And around that same time is some books are coming out, in particular Mark Elliott's The Dark Prince of Hollywood. Terrible book, terrible for lots of reasons. We can do a whole podcast on that where I can go through not only the errors in that book, but, you know, why Elliot went to writing that in the first place. And Diane saw that the Disney company was not stepping up to the bat and saying, well, these things are wrong. And now Diane never complained if people said something bad about her dad. She said, yeah, he had a temper. I know there are some people who didn't like him. He was a human being. What she disliked was everybody who made those psychological jumps. Oh, he did this because he really didn't love Lillian. Right. You know, he didn't take Lillian to this because he really didn't love Lillian. No, it was because Lillian didn't want to go to that event. And so that was her complaint with the Neil Gabler book that's out there, too, is that Gabler doesn't just write the facts, and there's some really great facts in there, is he makes some psychological assumptions, and they're completely off the bat.
He never met Walt, obviously.
No, absolutely not. And so Diane had to step out of the shadows. I remember the very first time I met her was at one of the Disneyana conventions that they had out here in Florida back in the days when Disney really did those terrific Disneyana conventions. And she wasn't announced. She was a surprise guest because she wanted to have the right to back out, you know, the minute before she went up on stage, because she was really scared of the Disney fans. She had no idea. She felt that they were going to be bored listening to her, or they were going to storm the stage, you know, to try and grab at her arm or something like that. You know, I touched Diane Disney, you know, that type of thing. She was absolutely scared. And she got up there on stage and started to talk, started to tell a couple of stories. She went on longer than she was scheduled. She wanted a very, you know, little short slot because, you know, that you could drop a pin in that audit. Hundreds of people, they're on their edge of their seats. They're leaning in. They're afraid to breathe because they'll miss a word. Because, again, she was very quiet, you know, and all of this. And then I saw her. This is when I first met her, is when she was immediately brought off stage, and I got a chance to talk with her briefly, and she was just overwhelmed. She was just overwhelmed at the love that she thought it was a fluke, that all, you know.
Well, because her story is unique, because you may hear from people that knew Walt and they worked with Walt, but that was his only daughter, and that was really sort of the first time that we were able to, I was not there, but yeah, we as a community were able to hear from, mm-hmm, you know, Walt's child.
Yes, absolutely. And so it then started to progress from there. And especially when the Walt Disney Concert Hall opened to such success in 2004, that's when she started to think about, you know, I'm going to do something more public, you know. I'm going to be the public face. That's why she showed up in 2005 for the 50th of Disneyland. She gave permission, you know, she had written, well, she hadn't, she was very self-effacing about this. There's the book, The Story of Walt Disney by Diane Disney Miller as told to Pete Martin. And she was always very embarrassed. She said, I wish they would change that. She said it was Pete Martin who did all of that. She said, what happened is Saturday Evening Post had come to my dad and offered him $150,000, you know, to be interviewed to write his autobiography, you know, in six chapters. And Walt didn't want to do that. He felt that biographies were for people who had already accomplished everything they were already going to accomplish, and he still had so much more to do. But he knew that Ron and Diane needed the money, also wanted to support her writing, and so offered and said, well, my daughter could do that. So they immediately cut the offer in half, and Diane said, I understood that. And she said, I was there at the tapings, and I piped up every now and then, but I have the recordings, and I have the transcript, and there are reels where Pete Martin is just interviewing her, and she is just magnificent. But anyway, that book came out, and she owned the copyright on it, and she allowed that as a limited edition reprinting in 2005. I bet a lot of people don't know that, and that's one another book you should track down for your library. But anyway, she decided she needed to step up and be the public face, and that she was worried that the Disney company was marketing her dad as a thing, mm-hmm. like another Disney cartoon character, whatever, and that there's an entire generation that had grown up not seeing Walt on TV. And she wanted a place where she could showcase the Walt as a son, a brother, a husband, a father, and she's done an absolute magnificent job up there.
Well, and just you know, the timing too, because that's when mm-hmm. we're starting to hear that college students think that Walt Disney is like Aunt Jemima or the Quaker Oats guy. It's not really a real. We today say, you know, we can't believe that. So, not that she was sort of forced to be brought out, but this is when she sort of she felt the need to sort of take up the sword and be the champion of his personal legacy, which was not being acknowledged, at least in a positive way, anywhere else.
Right, and the company wasn't coming out that way. Very similar to Roy E. Disney, who had to step up in 1984 to take over animation. I was telling you a little earlier that when Eisner and Katzenberg came on board and was looking at, you know, Disney Film Entertainment and all of that, they had made the decision that there were plenty of Disney animated features and cartoons, and you could just re-release those every 7 years for eternity. So that was fine. There was no reason to continue because animation was time-consuming, it was labor-intensive, it was expensive, and, you know, you really didn't get as much of an immediate return on it. And so Eisner was seriously considering closing the animation department. Now, what had happened is Roy had helped Eisner get his position. And so Eisner knew that Roy had a marker that he was going to call in. And so he literally was in a cold sweat. What was this going to be about? And is this going to, you know, interfere with things that I really want to do, you know, with the parks and, you know, bringing this and whatever? And it was Roy who said, no, I want to be in charge of animation. And Eisner let out this sigh of relief because he could see that animation was just going downhill. And so he figured, you know what? This is great because this pays off the debt to Roy. And when animation goes under, it goes under in the hands of a Disney. And my hands are clean. Now, of course, when, you know, Little Mermaid hits and all that, now it's Eisner who's the genius. Yes, that I could see that this needed to be revitalized and all this. And so Roy, of course, also had all of these little side projects that helped out tremendously in terms of animation. One of them was restoring Richard Williams' masterpiece, The Thief and the Cobbler. And that didn't get completed, unfortunately. Roy passed away. You don't have a champion for that. Roy was the champion who said, yes, you open the Disney archives to Leslie Iwerks so she can get that material and those images she can use in a documentary and use in her book. That's Roy stepping up to the bat for that. And so many things. And he didn't want recognition for that. You know, he just did it because it was the right thing to do.
I would say there seems to be a consistent pattern of humility among the Disneys.
Yes. That you know, just because we're a Disney doesn't make us anything, you know, special. And it's almost like it's our responsibility to give back. I was, especially with the anniversary of the assassination of John F. Kennedy. I've been watching all of these specials on TV, and at one time, you know, Adlai Stevenson, before JFK was going to be the Democratic nominee for president, and Adlai Stevenson was an intellectual and came from a very wealthy family. He did not want to go into politics. But if you read about him, he feels that it's his responsibility. Because he had been given so much, he needed to return. And he saw public service as the way of doing that. And I think the Disney family did that as well. Diane did so many things behind the scenes. She's supported so many Disney historians, not only in their research, but just as a cheerleader of, oh, I love that, and you need to do more of that, and you need to get that out there. So, you know, J.B. Kaufman's two books on Snow White that came out last Christmas, and the one that's going to be coming out that he wrote on Pinocchio, that's all due to Diane Disney and pulling strings and doing things and going that. Didier Getz is going to have a wonderful book out in December called Disney's Grand Tour, which focuses just on 1 year of Walt's life, 1935, which was a pivotal year. And I talked with Didier on the day Diane passed away, and he was just in tears that she would not be able to see the physical copy of that book. She wrote the foreword. She had seen the final draft and all that, but he wanted to be able to give her, you know, a hard copy of the book and say, thank you so much. This book would not exist without you and everything that you did. And she's done lots of that. And again, she had so many programs and educational projects and all that.
They do it at the museum, too. They very much sort of foster these kind of things for young kids or young artists to come in and sort of learn and share their work as well, too.
Well, I'll tell you how shy she was. I did a presentation up at the Family Museum on Walt's love of outer space. And I'd gotten a chance to have lunch with Diane and Ron, and that's a whole nother podcast in itself. And we had chili, just like Walt. And I was told, you know, don't be upset if Diane doesn't show up for your presentation. We're recording it, you know, so she can watch it, but she sometimes doesn't like to show up because she doesn't want to steal, you know, attention. But we always leave these seats in the back open for Ron and Diane. So I'm starting my presentation, and out of the corner of my eye, I see Ron and Diane come in and sit for my presentation. But I had also been warned by the, you know, as your presentation ends, they'll leave because, again, they don't want to attract attention. They don't want to steal attention from you. And they not only stayed, Diane asked questions. And later people at the museum go, do you know how unusual that is?
Right.
He never did. And I said, really? But yeah, she was...
Well, she always liked you, and she liked, yeah, she liked the kind of work because... Not to compare, but like her, you very much are interested in preserving the legacy of Walt and sharing the stories of that. And I think she likes that you help to be a positive voice for her father and the stories that most people don't get a chance to hear.
Yes, she, and she told that we corresponded by email, we talked on the phone, all of that. And again, she wrote the foreword for my first book, the first Vault of Walt book. And in there, it's like, you know, I love Jim's writing. He doesn't put my dad up on a pedestal. He just tells the facts. But I can really hear the sound of my dad when I'm reading his story. And I'm sitting there going, okay, take me now. It's never going to get better than this.
Right. There's no higher compliment you could be paid than hearing that from Walt's daughter.
And again, I just had and still have such great affection and respect for her. You know, she's just an incredible woman. And again, that's why it makes it so frustrating, so sad that, you know, the simplest of things can take somebody from you in a moment. You know, how fragile and tentative life is, and I'm sure her family is just devastated. And to show you again how private the family is, they said, you know, don't send notes and cards and flowers and things like that, but make a donation to the Walt Disney Family Museum. They've set up a special Diane Disney Memorial Fund, so you can find that on their website there. But you know, she had seven kids. She had 13 grandkids, and what was wonderful was just a short while ago she was able to see her first great granddaughter. You know, how amazing is that for people? And I know there's been a lot of wonderful tributes out there. I would recommend taking a look on the web for Leonard Maltin, mm-hmm. who did a wonderful piece on her. And one of the things that Leonard said that I wish I had said, but I'm going to say it now anyway because Leonard's not here, is he said, every time you were with Diane, you were almost pinching yourself because I'm with Walt Disney's daughter.
Yeah.
I'm with Walt Disney's daughter. Oh, my gosh. You know, just pinching away. And she had a great sense of curiosity, you know, just like her dad. You know, you always read about how curious Walt was. She was always curious, and the joy that would come on her face. Up at the museum, somebody had brought in, Walt had done two ads for a DeSoto car, and was showing these to Diane. They were big full-page ads that were in things like Life and Look, and she goes, that's just odd because Dad never drove a DeSoto, and he always liked convertibles, and that's not a convertible. And I said, oh, well, the story behind that is that DeSoto came and all of that, and your dad said, well, I can't do that. I don't need another car, and I don't drive DeSoto. But his mom and dad, Elias and Flora, were alive, and they said, well, we don't have a car. And so Walt did it so they could have a car. And her face just like, shit, oh, my, he would do something like that. That's just so marvelous. Later I sent her documentation to reinforce that. I had a quote from Sharon Disney, who had passed away from cancer in 1993. Mm-hmm. You know, to confirm that. But she was just so excited that this information had come out and that it was available and other people, you know, could have that. So, and again, the sad thing too is there's lots of questions I wanted to ask her, and some I always just hesitated and never asked her because some of them were, you know, a little in gray areas that might have set off her temper simply because it was a private area. Many times I said, oh, you should let people know that. She says, it's none of their business. and as I said, she shared some stories with me. Maybe I'll share those later down the line. But again, she didn't want to share too many stories because then people took them and it was no longer her story. It was no longer her story of her and her dad. So I think we'll give some respectful time. But again, I think those stories should be out there. Just like so many other people, Ron Heminger told me some great stories, and he said, But you can't write any of these down. You need to promise you can't write any of these down because I'm going to write a book one day. And that was 13 years ago. 13 years ago.
That's why you said you never tell people you're writing a book because they're just like, well, you told me 13 years ago you were writing it.
And so, yeah, that was just great. And, I'm fortunate in one of the new books that I have out, The Vault of Walt, Volume 2. I'm fortunate in two ways. First off, I have a wonderful foreword by Lou Mangiello. But also in the book, I have a chapter which is called The Cute Disney Story That Never Was. And I had written this story about Diane and Sharon and Lillian going to Europe, and Diane wrote to me and she said, "That's not true at all." And I said, "But your dad said this for American Magazine, and then he also repeated this for that." She said, "My dad always loved to exaggerate sometimes, embellish a story." She says, "There's truth in there, but that's not the exact way it happened." And so she told me the exact way it happened. And so in the book, I have the story that Walt told. So you'll see that core of truth in there. And then her version of it, and it's an even better story. It's an even better story. I think it's better because it's in her own words as that comes in. But, again, that's why I write books, because I feel these stories need to be recorded or they're going to be lost. How many stories are lost? With Diane's passing, how many stories are lost that only she knew, that only she could tell? And she didn't know everything. She didn't know a lot of the people that her dad worked with, at work or that. She didn't know that sometimes her dad was really stressed about finances because he kept it hidden, from his kids and things like that. But there are stories out there, and it's important to get these down. I know one reviewer said, "Oh yes, Vault of Walt, Volume 2. Yes, it's a fun book, but these are just really, as slight stories. They're just not." And it's like, no, you're missing the whole point. These are the stories that you can't find in any other book. These are the stories between the lines. These are the stories that come after the one sentence description of this going on. And yes, Diane stocked all of my books prominently out there at the museum, facing out, so you see the cover for crying out loud, and just one of the many, many ways that she supported me. But I tried my best not to abuse that friendship, because a lot of people did, especially when the Walt Disney Family Museum was being built. She brought on a couple of people, and the people charged first-class plane flights and expensive meals and the top-of-the-line hotels and all that. And when those bills started coming in, it was like, we don't expect you to be living out of a Motel 6, but we don't expect the penthouse service here, But they figured, oh, well, it's Disney. They got deep pockets. They've got all of this here. And I think even as a newlywed, they struggled for money. So Diane was very aware of the importance of money. I tell people I'm at that point in my life where people should really give me money, because I know how to use it now. When I was younger, I would have just thrown it away on Las Vegas and private libraries and whatever.
Well, look, that's why I like you coming on, because you do share the stories that we're not going to find anywhere else. And I say this to you all the time, and it's not just because you're mm-hmm. here, but nobody tells a story the way you do. And what makes your storytelling, both on the show and in the books, so interesting and so valuable, it's not just the way that you tell it, but you are an incredible researcher, and you also are able to draw from your personal experience and your personal knowledge that other people can't get. The fact that you've met Diane, you spoke with mm-hmm. Diane, gives you a certain insight that those of us who may have met her only briefly could never sort of touch. And that's why I love the Vault of Walt books. I have to have you come back on, not just to talk more about Vault of Walt, but certainly the Book of Mouse as well, too, because nobody saw this book coming, and you're showing me a galley copy today, and I'm fascinated by not just how you have the book laid out, but the information that's in there, all about, you know, Walt's one and only favorite son, I guess. But again, this was a very nice and hopefully interesting tribute and celebration of Walt's daughter that maybe we didn't know beforehand. And I think you're right. I think you said something early on about we will not get a firm understanding of her legacy and her value and more mm-hmm. of these stories until months or years go by. But I am very grateful to you for coming on now to sort of introduce us on a much more personal level to Sharon, the person, not just Sharon, Walt's daughter.
Yes, and I think in the comments section, this is a perfect place for those listeners who did meet her at, you know, the family museum or even worked up at the family museum, whatever. I'll bet that you have stories much similar to the ones that we share about how gracious and elegant she was and, you know, if she smiled, you know, your heart smiled as well. And as Lou said, yeah, for years I've been working on a one-source resource book for Mickey Mouse, complete filmography of movie and TV, Mickey in the Parks, 10 pages of quotes by Walt on Mickey Mouse and all sorts of little Mickey Mouse fun facts that on... Christmas 1937, Adolf Hitler got a Christmas gift from Joseph Goebbels of 18 Mickey Mouse cartoons because Hitler loved watching them in his private screening room. So go to themeparkpress.com and you'll find more out about these books. You can see some samples of those if you don't want to go immediately to Amazon. Lou, always a delight to talk to you. We've got to do this more often, you know, and I appreciate you buying me breakfast. And for those of you who've seen the new and improved and slender Lou, he was on his best behavior. His mouth watered for macadamia pineapple pancakes and Tonga toast, but he had a egg white omelet and fruit. Egg white omelet and fruit.
Yeah, we have to do this more often. We have to get you back again, and of course we'll definitely sort of plan it around another meal together as well, because I enjoy not just your stories and not just your work, but most importantly I enjoy your friendship.
And it right back at you, buddy. And I'm sure 20 years from now people are going to be asking me, well, what are the Lou Mangiello stories that...
Oh, you can't tell those.
Well, when he was interviewing me on the podcast, he was always, you know, checking his texts, and he was picking his teeth, and he was playing with squirrels running around, you know.
We've got to get this non-disclosure agreement signed as soon as possible. All right, again, Jim Corcus, Book of Mouse, Vault of Walt. I'll put links in the show notes to all this kind of stuff as well. I look forward to having you back.
Thank you again.
Time for our Walt Disney World Trivia Question of the Week, where I invite you to test your knowledge of Walt Disney World history or trivia, see how well you pay attention to the details in what you see, or maybe even in what you hear, and then randomly select one entry from all the correct entries for a chance to win a Disney prize package. Before we get to this week's question, let's go back, review last week's, and select our winner. So last time I was talking about the Brad Bird film Tomorrowland, which was actually shooting in Walt Disney World's Tomorrowland when I was recording the show. So your question was about one of my favorite attractions, the classic, Walt Disney's Carousel of Progress. And your question was this: tell me the names of the parents in the Carousel of Progress. Well, again, hundreds of you either Googled very well or love the show and really pay attention, because you knew that the parents' names are John and Sarah. And if you paid close attention, you learned Sarah's name while she's making the costumes for the 4th of July parade. So again, I took all the correct entries, randomly selected one, and the winner of the audio tours, luggage tag, button, and signed copy of my Walt Disney World Trivia Book Volume 2 is Mary Bella. So Mary, congratulations. Send me your address. I'll get your prize package out to you right away. If you didn't win last week, that's okay, because here's your next chance in this week's Walt Disney World Trivia Challenge. So on this week's show, hopefully we all learned a little bit more about Diane Disney Miller and that she had a sister, Sharon. But do you know the name of Walt's siblings? That's your question for this week. Tell me the names of all of Walt Disney's siblings. I'll give you a hint and a head start. One was named Roy. You have until Sunday, December 1st at 11:59 p.m. Again, you'll be playing for all the audio tours, a luggage tag, button, and a signed copy of my Walt Disney World Trivia Book Volume 2. Hey, listen, if you're looking for a holiday gift for somebody, here you go if you have one for yourself. So you have until Sunday, December 1st, 11:59 p.m. to send your answers to contest at wdwradio.com. Good luck and have fun. That's going to do it for this week's show. Thanks so much for taking the time and tuning in. In the spirit of Thanksgiving, I really want to take a minute to thank you from the bottom of my heart for tuning in every week and for the friendship and support you have given me throughout this year and for so, so long. Don't forget that in addition to the podcast, which you can subscribe to over on iTunes, be sure and visit the website at wdwradio.com. There, you can check our multiple daily blog posts from lots of great contributors. There's also our fun, free, family-friendly discussion forums. You can sign up for our free email newsletter with lots of exclusive content, contests, offers, and much more. You can download the free WDW Radio app. You can check out my new videos, subscribe to the YouTube channel, and lots more. Again, everything is over at wdwradio.com. You can also shop for my Walt Disney World trivia books and audio tours there as well. You know I love hearing from you, so if you have a question you want answered on the air, you can email me at lou@wdwradio. You can also call the voicemail at 407-900-9391. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Lou Mangiello. And come like our Facebook page at facebook.com/wdwradio. But as much as I love hearing from you online, nothing beats a handshake and a hug. And our final meet of the month in Walt Disney World is going to be Sunday, December 22nd in Downtown Disney. And it's going to be a little something special because this is going to be our special holiday edition. We're going to start off at 9 a.m. at Downtown Disney's Earl of Sandwich, where you can come in your favorite ugly Christmas sweater if you want, enjoy some breakfast, and then we're going to head on over to the first scheduled showing of Saving Mr. Banks over at the Downtown Disney AMC Theater. More information, times, and location can be found on the events page both at wdwradio.com and at facebook.com/wdwradio. Big thanks, as always, to my partners and sponsors, including Mouse Fan Travel. They are my official recommended travel provider, whether you're coming out to Walt Disney World, over to Disneyland, Adventures by Disney, Disney Cruise Line, Aulani, whatever it may be. You can check out mousefantravel.com for the best possible prices, all available discounts. Most importantly, an incredible level of personal service that is their hallmark. And as always, my friends, and you are my friends, whether we have met yet or not, all I ask is that if you like the show, please help spread the word. Tell your friends about it. Tweet out that you're listening. Come by, comment, and share links over on Facebook. And please come by, rate and review the show and the apps over in iTunes as well. And again, I don't need Thanksgiving Day to be thankful to all of you for listening and for letting me share my passion for Disney with you. And I want you to feel that same way of being excited every morning about what you do. So remember, you always still have time to create your fate. Don't be afraid to risk, to leap, or to change, and never, ever settle, and always keep moving forward. Have a great week, everybody. Happy Thanksgiving. See ya.
Hi, Lou. This is Tim in Suwanee, Georgia. Just finished listening to episode 342, and I'm sure everybody in the listening audience feels like I do. It was so great to hear a little bit about the man behind the story. And we appreciate you and Ridley sharing a little of your personal story. It was very inspiring and just a whole lot of fun, and thanks a lot. And we appreciate again how much work you put into the stuff you do that we get to enjoy. So thanks a lot, Lou. Bye-bye.
Hi, Lou. This is Brian Harvey, also known as Brian Harvey 967 in the box for all the box people out there. I just wanted to say thank you so much. You have made my day like you can't believe when you drew my name for the trivia contest last week. I am so looking forward to the holiday event with the National Fantasy Fan Club. Anxious to see you there. Have to say that when I moved here 3 years ago, and it took me a year and a half, but I have heard every single one of your podcasts. I listen to it every week, and I'm in the box on Wednesday nights, and I'm so happy that our life paths have crossed. Love your motivational messages that you put up every day. I love your podcast, and we're going to get you that Podcast of the Year award, Lou. Keep up the great work, and I'll see you at the next meet and greet. Thanks, Lou. You've got a friend.